What's up and welcome to Ahead of the Curve. This is your host, Jonathan Gellner, and thank you so much for joining us today. This episode of Ahead of the Curve is brought to you by New Era. New Era is the official headwear provider of the MLB, NFL, and NBA. If you love to rock New Era caps as much as I do, then you don't want to miss out on this opportunity to wear what the players wear and get 15% off when you go to neweracaps.com/AOTC. Use the code AOTC, all lowercase, at checkout and get 15% off your code. Once again, that's AOTC, all lowercase, to get 15% off. On today's show, we have on Jeff Willis, head baseball coach at LSU Eunice. Jeff is entering his 22nd year as LSU's head coach, and to say he has been successful would be an understatement. The Bengals have established themselves as one of the most dominant junior college programs in the nation, holding an 820 winning percentage since his arrival in 2003, and they have never finished ranked lower than 7th in the country. LSU's winning percentage under Willis makes them the second winningest college baseball program in the history of the sport, regardless of affiliation or classification. LSU Eunice has won 7 NJCAA championships and also making 10 World Series appearances. The 7 national championships are tied for the most in the sport in NJCAA history for one school. Coach Willis has also cemented his place among the top coaches in the history of NJCAA athletics as he was enshrined into the National Coaches Hall of Fame in 2023, and it was also announced that he was an inductee to the ABCA Hall of Fame class of 2024. So on the show, we dive deep into what they do for program development in the fall. We talk about how to develop chaos on offense. And Coach Willis shares a ton of practical takeaways on competition teams and how to run practices in season. You're going to love this episode with Jeff Willis. Coach Willis, welcome to the show.
I appreciate you having me, Jonathan. You know, we worked on this a couple of times to try to get together, and happy we can do this today.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a follower of you from afar, and so I'm really excited to get to dig into some player development, because I know, you'll be humble and say, we try and do a good job, but you do put together one of the best player development programs in the country and send guys, everywhere all over the country. But I do want to really dig into what you guys are doing now. So tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing this fall. You know, we can even talk about this week. You know, you talked about you guys are about to do your fall World Series, but just kind of walk us through, when the guys got on campus in August or September, what you guys have done so far this fall.
Well, I always say the first day out, we've got to learn how to run the first base. I think you've got to break down the game into very small details and really focus on those. And if you continue to really just, you guys always heard, how do you eat an elephant? It's one bite at a time. You pound the stone type of philosophy as well. Just continue to pound that stone until it finally cracks. And I tell people all the time, we do the simplest things as just we're learning how to run to first base a certain way. Our guys got here in the middle of August and, had a full week of team meetings and paperwork that has to be done for school-wise. And then we really start small group sessions, four-on-ones at that junction. And that takes us all the way to Labor Day. And then we start our team practice after Labor Day. But a lot of time is spent in the classroom for those first 2 weeks. And then even now, we're still in the classroom time to time. We set things down with our players of really our pitching coach is the one that does it the most with our pitchers, of having different exams, just going over different situations, different things about the game. Because I think we've lost the thought process and the art of guys really watching the game of baseball. They're watching highlights. They're on social media and they're seeing the home run or they're seeing the spectacular play, but they're not seeing how the game is played collectively as a group. And so we want our guys to see that. We want to talk a lot about that. And we're big on making sure that we develop chemistry and develop camaraderie and things of that nature. And but we go all down to, offensively, what we're going to do, pitching staff wise, here's what we're going to do to how to attack the game. But there's a big focus during those first 2 weeks and then through the fall of really focusing on the smallest details we can.
No, I really like that a lot. And, I was talking to our coaches the other day. So we have our kids in our classroom for study hall every week, like once a week, for like 40 minutes. And so we actually started to like go through different clips, and usually I steal a bunch of them from Jerry Weinstein on Twitter, of just like, hey, let's break this down from a, you know, a standpoint. And in your neck of the woods, we call them HWA, like how to win awareness plays. Like, so we, the, one of them that we did the other day was the, when Bryce Harper got doubled off the wall to lose the one of the playoff games. And we just talked about how being in the right place, even though that may or may not have been a really aggressive, good base running move, the guy was doing what he was supposed to do. And, you know, when's the last time that that Riley had worked on backing up a throw from right center field after the guy catches it off the wall? So we went through like that, stuff like that. But could you give us some different practical examples of how you guys are teaching, you know, baseball IQ or HWA plays?
Yeah. So what we really, this is roughly a little over 10 years ago, I got really tired of yelling. I tired of yelling about this and this is not done right and this is not done right. And so what I did is I took one summer after our season and I basically took a legal notepad and set it next to my chair in my living room. And every night I would write different things that a point system basically of what this point was worth this. This is worth. We're all the way down to leadoff walks, to two out walks, to two out, you know, base hits, to two out RBIs, and this whole point system of all these different things that happen within a game of baseball, and then being able to do a subtraction and addition throughout every single day. And I broke that into categories that were on the field, off the field, community service, in the weight room, and just made this thing a whole competition through the fall. Is what I did. And then I didn't have to yell any. I just had to say, you know, if our guy, we're big about not moving our feet in the batter's box. I think that's a free 90. We don't want to get hurt by any means. And so we talk about how to protect ourselves, but just jumping out of the way out of a pitch, you can't be the best hitter you could possibly be. You've right. got to get your feet planted in the box and you've got to stay right there. Because if a guy can pitch inside and you're jumping back out of it, now you're susceptible to the outside pitch and you can't be the best hitter. And so you've got to get in there, plant your feet, protect yourself. You know, mm-hmm. we got all the gadgets in the world to wear now, put them on, and then learn how to protect your face, your neck, your front side of your body when a pitch does come inside. That's not saying mm-hmm. we're not teaching get hit by the pitch. We're teaching how to protect ourselves, but also how to become the best hitter we can possibly be. And so that's worth 20 points. If you jump out of the way, that's minus 20 for your team. And so we split our guys up into two teams in the fall. There's this whole point system competition that goes on, and you just get to yell out, that's minus 10, that's minus 5. And they all have the list. They're all given the list. It's posted in our locker room of what that point system. And then at the end of the fall, the week of Thanksgiving, there's a payout. And your team doesn't want to do that payout because – It's a 3-mile run. It's a bunch of calisthenics. It's an ab routine. And the guys that are returners that have had to do that, they very well right away make sure that the other guys on their team understand we don't want to do this. And so we don't have guys miss class. And I'll come out at practice from time to time and a guy's running a triangle and I don't know why he's running a triangle. And he's got a couple of his teammates up there and come to find out, he's like, coach, he missed class. And we don't miss class here. And so when you can get your team to understand it's their team, it's not the school's team, it's not the coach's team, it's not the alumni's team, it is their team. And when they have ownership over that team, look out of what, because now they start to police themselves. They start to hold each other accountable. Because the big thing is I don't want us to be at the very, very end of the year and everybody sees that, hey, we're playing for it all right now. And then somebody in the dugout or a bunch of guys in the dugout know so-and-so doesn't deserve to win, doesn't deserve to succeed because they've been halfway doing it in the dark when the coaches don't see it, but the players see it. Right. They don't want to know that that guy's walking up the plate with the game on the line, or they don't want to look out there with the guy on the mound and know that that guy doesn't deserve to succeed. And so when you get them to understand that and you get them to believe and know that they own the team, look out of what they're going to do. And what that point system has done is even magnified that ownership of the team even more than when we just used to talk about the team owned the team. It was their team. I tell them all the time, until we can run a practice without the coaches being there, we can't be the best team we can be. You've got to be able to, we should be able to put a practice schedule up and we've got a clock in our, on our scoreboard, and that thing should run, and everybody should know what to do and where to be. That's not saying our coaches are not going to be there, but you get the premise of if that thing can run without the coaches being there, now you're getting somewhere. And we've never gotten to that, but we've gotten really close to where the coaches didn't have to be there. And I felt like it could run its own course if that were the case. And so that's the biggest thing. That point system, that accountability has been huge for us. And absences, we don't see it. Guys don't miss class. We saw our grades skyrocket with it. We saw the togetherness and the, you know, because discipline is love.
Sure.
And when the coach disciplines, there's something. But when your own teammate has to step in and say, that's not how we do things here, and it's not going to work, and you're not going to be the best that you can be. And when you talk about the goal is not to win a championship, I've never talked to our teams about winning a national championship. I've never talked to them about winning the last game of the year. What I have talked about is being the best that you can possibly be in every single area of your life. And that's what I think that defines winning. I think winning's not on a scoreboard. I don't think it's in how much money you have, how much power, fame, those things. I think winning is taking your God-given ability and reaching your full potential in every area of your life. And if you can do that, now you're going to succeed. And I always tell people, I tell our team, we don't know how good our team is because we're not going to define our success based on if we win the last game or not. We'll define our success 10, 15 years down the road when you players become husbands and fathers. That's going to define our success then.
Oh, that's really good. So do you break them up into like small groups, or this is like the whole team holds everybody accountable?
Yeah. So there's two teams. And so if you go out to our practice this afternoon, one will be wearing a certain colored shirt. Another one, there's two teams there. And we make trades through the team through the year. If all of a sudden we get injuries and we need to switch some things up, or we feel like this guy might be better at a different position and that other team he needs to move to that. So we tell them at any point in time, you can be traded from the best, the point leading team to the seller, because life's not fair. And then we'll make trades for no reason too. Just to let them understand that life's not fair and you can be traded and at any point in time. You got to be able to get over that when all of a sudden life hits you and you feel like it's not fair. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to get up and continue to push along? Or are you going to cry? Are you going to go into a closet and cry yourself to sleep?
No, I love that. So we do a similar format with smaller groups. And I think that that's had a massive impact on like bringing together that togetherness too. I think that it's one of the things that like even this summer, the kids were like, hey, are we going to do competitions on Fridays? So we call them Fight Ready Fridays. So one of the things we talk about is like having good body language and like the key indicator or like how you would see it would be like you're in fight ready mode, like all the time, like UFC, like you're balled up, you're ready to go, or you're fisted up. That was one of their like favorite things. Cause you know how the fall can be, especially, you know, JUCO life and in high school, we get them for several hours a day and their attention spans are pulled 1,000 different directions, but they feel like, you know, one of the things that they do here, we do here is, when they go to different other sports competitions together, they get points. So, what are some other ways that you guys really like besides on-field stuff, do you guys do anything off-field for like your point system? You talked about missing class would be a designation for, you know,
oh yeah, there's a whole
written
list
up for that.
Yeah. There's a whole list. You know, if you get a professor sends a note that's not a good note, then there's minus points there. But on the flip side, if a professor sends an email or a note saying so-and-so is doing really reward that. And so
awesome.
There's a whole plus. I think the community service piece is pretty interesting just because they drive that. It's not me driving it. It's not our coaching staff driving it. They've got to go find community service projects because I'm big on if the coach is just dictating to them this and that and whatever it's in front of them, whether it's practice or whether it's this thing can't work as a dictatorship. It can't. There is a level of hierarchy that has to take place in any organization. But again, when you can break down the imaginary line of the coaches are over here and the players are over here and everybody is on the same team, then when you talk as a coach, they start to realize they're just looking out for my best interests. They're not trying to take it out on me. They're not trying to make me a fool. They're not trying to belittle me or anything in that regard. They actually see the purpose, and it's constructive criticism is what it is. And so when they get to know those things and you break down that imaginary line through those things, and community service is a great way. They go find them and they got to bring them to me and I approve them, and they, sure. they take ownership over that. And then you've got a lot more community service projects going, because then those teams split up into groups and do a lot more out there. And I'll tell you, I'm not big on, you know, I don't think I've ever posted anything anywhere about our players doing community service. I don't, I see people all the time that post that. And I cringe sometimes, because then I start to realize, what was their motivation for that? Was the motivation for just doing things, you know, for the right reasons, or did they do it to get a picture and to get a pat on the back? You shouldn't do community service. You shouldn't help somebody to get a thank you or to get a like or a post on social media. And so I talked to our team about it. Like, we're not going to take pictures of it. We're not going to post those things. If somebody else wants to do that, we're perfectly fine with that. But we are not going to post it to get our own condemnation of this is what we accomplished. We don't need a thank you. We don't need a pat on the back. We just want to go help people in that regard. And I think when you teach young people that, now they start to do things for the right reasons, not for some superficial reason of I'm just doing it to get recognition, or I'm just doing it to get, you know, for the wrong reasons for the most part.
Right. No, that's really good. By the way, congratulations for your ABCA Hall of Fame nod this year. I was reading your bio and I was like, oh, that's awesome.
And I'm getting old, and I appreciate that. But again, I say this all the time, any awards that coaches get, those are program, those are team awards, because without assistant coaches, without administrators, without the players, without any of that, none of that ever takes place. And so it's just a byproduct of the people that you've been surrounded by. And I think it's a shame that assistant coaches don't get more recognition. I don't ever, when you see these coaches of the year, I look at that and I say, well, it should be the staff of the year is what it should be. And I wish some of those organizations would kind of, you know, change those wordings to staffs of the year, so everybody gets recognition through that. Because again, it's not one person, it's a collective unit of everybody that was involved.
Right. No, that's really good. So, you know, one of the things that you're having to establish, especially when you have guys for, you know, a year or 2 years and then they move on, is your standards of performance and, you know, maybe your rules, and you have to like hit them over the head with it pretty fairly quickly, which is probably why you spent so much time in the classroom early on. But talk to us just about like how you get across how high of standards you guys. I mean, and that's why they come there, right? Because they want to be championships or win championships on and off the field. But talk to us a little bit about how you indoctrinate the guys that come in and just make sure that they know the expectations, and that, you know, if you've got some different situations of where you had a kid that did this and then he developed, you know, into what you guys wanted, anything along those, because we talk about standards all the time, but it's different when they're living and breathing versus whenever they're just words on a wall, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think I don't have a lot of rules. I'm not, you know, like this has to happen and this and that. And I think when you do that, you don't allow yourself the freedom to be a human from time to time. I think this old thought process that you, especially in sports, that you treat every single player the exact same. I think there's some question marks with that. Some people don't understand different people's backgrounds. You know, if a certain player screwed up and did this, they might know better than doing that versus someone that came from a situation where they didn't have a father. You know, they weren't taught. And that's not making excuses. I'm not big about making excuses. And I'm always talking to our guys and calling them out when I hear transfer of blame to this and that. But I think you have to take each situation and find out why the motivation of why the screw up took place. And if that's off the field, finding out why that took place. And, you know, I think I cringe when I hear people say that the kids are different today than they were 20 years ago. They're not different. They're the same as they were 20 years ago. I will say who is different is the people that were holding them accountable. Those are people that are different. They're not setting the same standard of what was being held accountable 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so the kids don't know. They don't know. So we've got to do our job of teaching through those mistakes, teaching through those failures and shortcomings through it. But the big thing is we have a hashtag of things that doesn't have anything to do with baseball. Has everything to do about life. And I think when you shoot for that, the baseball side of things starts to fall into place. You know, I started telling recruits when they come on a recruiting visit, I don't really care much about their baseball career. And right when I say that, you can see their body language will change, because I know they're not in my office sitting here talking to me if they didn't want to play baseball here and that wasn't a huge part of their life. And I have to tell them, like, hang on here. I want to talk a little bit about this. What I do care about is we're going to shoot for you as a human being and what it looks like to be a champion in every area of your life. And when I start to talk like that, and I say, no, a baseball player will come underneath that. But that hashtag that we have, there's four letters. It's DDCS. The first D stands for we'll develop men. And I tell those recruits, I tell our players, it doesn't say develop baseball players. It says develop men and what that looks like. What it looks like to be a father, what it looks like to lead your family, what do those parameters actually look like? And so develop men, and I tell them it's a constant development process for all of us. It doesn't matter if we're 14 or if we're 27 or if we're 62. It's a constant development phase for all of us that we're either moving in a positive direction or a negative direction, and there's no standing still. And if you are standing still, you're getting bypassed by people, so you are moving backwards in that resolve. If I look at, you know, the second D, deserve to win, and you could change that to deserve to succeed, deserve to have something good happen to you. And I think all of us either deserve to win, deserve to succeed, deserve to have something good happen to us, or we don't. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with your attitude and your work ethic. And you can't change a lot of things, and everybody's looking for the controllables. And those two things of your attitude and work ethic and whether you deserve to win or deserve to succeed, you control that. And so when you can say that and then put that into perspective of you control your confidence level too. Mm-hmm. Everybody is searching for confidence. I don't care what age you are. You're searching for confidence.
Absolutely.
There's a fine line between being arrogant and being confident. And there's nothing wrong with flirting with that line. We can't be mm-hmm. arrogant. We right. can't be prideful, but nobody can succeed without confidence. And I can tell you this, I can motivate you a little bit and I can push you in the right direction, but your confidence comes from within. Your confidence comes from knowing that you're prepared for whatever's in front of you or whatever task you're getting ready to try to accomplish is where your confidence comes from. And there's another piece of that too. And mm-hmm. Everybody's got to come to that forefront at some point in their life of knowing the big man upstairs has got their back or not. Mm-hmm. And so when you know that, and you know that you can be the same person every day, no matter the circumstances that are surrounding you, that's really the goal. Absolutely. And so, you know, Jonathan, right now you either deserve to win, deserve to succeed, or you don't. And same right. thing with me right now. And if you got guys or you got people that are struggling with confidence, something going on, whether they're not being the person they're supposed to be, or they're not prepared for whatever they're trying to accomplish as well. And so develop men, deserve to win. The C stands for compete in everything. I think life's a competition. And I think when you wake up, you're either going to – everybody's seen the old cartoon or the old poster that when you wake up, you better be running because somebody's going to yep. be running after you. And I'll equate that to a train. If you're a train on a track and you're leading right now, if your train slows down, the train behind you, guess what's going to do? They're going to run your rear end right off the tracks, and they're going to derail you. So there's no slowing down in it. You've got to continue to strive to be better than what you were yesterday. And there's an accountability mirror that's in your bathroom every single day that you wake up and you brush your teeth. And you can lie to everybody around you, but the person you can't lie to is the person staring you back in that mirror. And yep. I tell our players all the time, you've got an accountability mirror. Look yourself in the mirror and you either deserve to win. Did you compete that day? In the classroom, did you compete? And yeah. there's no question we've all been born with different talents. And the classroom's one of them. You know, certain individuals have been gifted with the ability to go and they can make A's very, very easily, whereas you may have been gifted with the ability of being a C student. Mm-hmm. And so if this A student that's been given that ability gets B's in the classroom and the C student gets C's in the classroom, who's more successful?
Right.
The C student is, because they lived up to their potential. But our world would tell it, oh, the B, that was higher than the C. No. They shortchanged themselves and they didn't live up to the potential that they were actually given. And so, you know, wake up with the mindset of competitive. You know, I said this to our team the other day. I said, our country was not built on people that said, I tried hard. It wasn't, our country was not built on the thought process of, I gave my best effort. Mm-hmm. Like, our country wasn't built on that. It was built on, you better get the job done or this country doesn't exist, when our founding people, you know, develop our country. And I look at things sometimes and I think we've got this mindset now of, I tried hard, so that's good enough. Mm-hmm. Or I gave my best effort, that's good enough. And we all would agree that's commendable. That's right. What you want to do. But at the end of the day, you've got to get the job done. And again, you and I are not sitting here if we didn't have people that got the job done when people were fighting to develop our country, right. Which I believe is the greatest country in the world. Sure. And we'll never, ever truly understand what a blessing it was for us just to be born here. You know, you didn't get to choose where you were born. I didn't get to choose where I was born. And by the sheer grace of God, we got to be born in the greatest country in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really good.
The last part of that DDCS, the S. Mm-hmm. That S is actually selflessness, which is the most important one. When you can care more about the person next to you than your own self, you're going to get somewhere. And so I equate that to, if you're on a team and you're not playing, what are you doing when you're in the dugout? Are you hoping the guy in front of you is failing and screws up so you get a chance? Or are you selfless and you're actually rooting on that person? Because if you are rooting on that person, and then you'll get your time at some point. And when you do, you will know you deserve to win at that point. But if you mm-hmm. were hoping and wishing they screwed up or somebody got injured or things of that nature, you don't deserve to win. You don't deserve to succeed. And when you get your chance, you're going to fall on your face because there's no confidence involved in that. Whereas if you're the good teammate, and you're high-fiving that individual and great play and things, and you're supporting it, when your number's called, now you have confidence because you've done it the right way.
Yep. No, I'm right there with you. So I do want to, because, you know, you've had a couple of years to really hone this whole process. Is it, you've been there over 20 years, right?
I have. This is my 22nd year. Yep.
Okay. So I do. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your story when you started there, because, you know, a lot of people will see all the different things that you've accomplished there. And when you took over the program, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't where it's at now. And so I was reading this in Collegiate Magazine or Collegiate Baseball the other day. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to have you hit on this because this is such, because you see it now, you see all the highlights, but tell us a little bit about what it was like whenever you got started, because a lot of our coaches are, you know, are changing jobs or had changed over the course of a season. So this is 20 plus years of you getting to experience this stuff in your program. But tell us about what it was like whenever you first started and how you got the ball rolling to where it is now.
Well, I got hired when I was 24 and I was mm-hmm. happy to have a job because I don't think colleges hire 24-year-olds at a college head coaching position. They just don't do that. And so I was happy to have a job. And what I was stepped into was a place, very, very small budget. No assistant coaches, no scholarships, by myself, throwing every BP round, coaching third base, calling every pitch, raising money for the first scholarship. School wouldn't give us scholarships, so I raised money for that, raised the money for my first assistant coach because I knew there's no way that this would succeed without having good assistant coaches, raised money for the budget. And then the first year I had 80 players. My first day was Tuesday after Labor Day in the fall. Mm-hmm. I had basically 80 players looking at me and I didn't know what to do other than I did not want to know who the starting shortstop was from the previous year, the starting center field. I didn't want to know any information about that kind of stuff. Because what I figured out was I could not manage that big of a number. And so what I did was we just started running. And I knew that if we did that, I would know what was inside the guys' hearts at that point in time. And we had guys walking off and guys quitting. And sure enough, some of them were the players that were really good the previous year. And but what I got down to was a group of young people that if you got in a street fight with them, you weren't winning. And I can tell you there's never been a team here that would have gotten into street fight with that team that was here in the fall of 2002, spring of 2003. We had one kid that still wind up, still is probably to this day the best pitcher we've ever had. He was a shortstop. And I told him, you're not going to play short. He almost quit on me. And I said, if you're not going to play short, you're going to pitch. And he did quit. And then he came back the next day. But he didn't quit in front of the team or anything in that regard. But again, we would show up and take batting practice on the road, and we could barely hit it to the outfielders in batting practice. The teams we were playing back then, the bats were different. They're just launching balls out of the park. And we would show up, and next thing you know, the game, we would run roll. And it was, we were bunting, and we were running the bases, and we were playing extremely hard, and they cared about each other, and they started believing in each other, and they wound up, they won 39 games that year, and they were one win away from going to the World Series. We didn't have any scholarships. And so I raised money that year to give out scholarship for the next year's team, and we gave out $9,000 of scholarship money for the next year's team, and we wound up third at the World Series at that point. And so at that point, I asked our institution, can we get some scholarships? And no, we don't have money. The school had money for scholarships. No, we're not going to give you any money for scholarships. I said, oh, well, then we'll raise it. But what happened was our team went to our state capitol at that point, and we got recognized on the House and Senate floor. And our chancellor at that point, the ride over, said, no, we don't have money for scholarships. And by the time we were riding back over, I asked the question again after the rec, because I said, has our school ever been in the state capitol? He said, no, it's never been in the state capitol. So on the ride home, I asked again. He goes, yeah, we're going to see what we can do. And then we won our first national championship in 2006. With basically the half of the scholarships of what our competition was used, what we were up against. And I knew that would just be a fluke, and that would be a one-year thing. You couldn't sustain that if you didn't get on equal ground of what your competition had. And so the same conversation was had after 2006, and the same thing was answered. We don't have money, but by the end of the ride back to the state capitol, it was, okay, we're gonna do what's right here and do this with the team. But, you know, I think everybody looks at us a lot of times and think we have three letters on our name, the LSU, and they think we have all this money, and we don't. We still fundraise. We fundraise our meal money. We fundraise travel money. We fundraise equipment money. We fundraise all this stuff that a lot of our competition probably doesn't have to do. And we've done it all the time. And I knew what I signed up for. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud that those kids are a part of that, because we do feel like we've made our program into one of the best in the country through that time. And I always cringe when I talk to a young coach or someone that comes and plays us, and they start to say, I don't have this, I don't have that, and all this. I'm going, you don't want it very bad then. Because if you did want it, you could figure out a way to do it. And it may take more work than somebody that's just given something and gifted something. But if you really cared enough about it, you'd figure out how to do it. And I think through our players, and when we hired those assistant coaches, we've been able to collectively do that here with what we've been able to accomplish.
So with that, you know, one of the things that that I thought was interesting that I learned last week. So you talked about selfless, right? And how big of a part of that is in your program. And I said this to our kids, and it was Shane Battier, and they were talking about, you know, the history of Moneyball and how he was, you know, super valuable as a teammate and the different things that he did. And he goes, you know, he said, I got to the league and I was underrated and, you know, all of these different things. And he said, and I chose not to take that, you know, I took it personally to be the best version of myself and to be the best teammate. He said, but I always have people that ask me these two questions. And he said, nobody ever asked me how many points I scored because I don't know, or how many rebounds I got. He said, but they do ask me, you know, where I keep my two championship rings and how I decide to wear which one I decide to wear. And he said, those are the two things that drive me, because that's success as an entire group and not of yourself. And then he talked, you know, they asked him, cause I guess he's got some kids that are going through basketball right now, and how he felt like that was a big deal of, you know, we're all about ourselves in society now. And maybe, you know, inherently we always have been, but he said he feels like it's worse, you know, and then he went on a rant about that. But I always thought that was really good. And I said it to our kids of, you know, what the only thing that they ask me is, you know, where I keep my championship rings and which ones I decide to wear. I thought that was really good.
Yeah. I know I've had that question asked to me several times. I don't know where they are at. my wife knows.
That's awesome.
I've never worn them. I've never worn them out in public. I've never, I think the last one, the last couple, I don't even know if I put it on, because I don't think that deems you successful. I don't think winning a game deems you successful. I've seen teams that didn't win the last game of the year that were highly successful. You've played in games where you played extremely well, and then you came out second on the scoreboard. That doesn't make you a loser. And then you've played games that you haven't played well, and you had all kinds of mental mistakes, and you wind up winning the game on the scoreboard. That didn't make you a winner. And so I think it's slowing things down and really defining what a winner really is, like we talked about earlier.
Right.
And, you know, our last year's team, you know, we were 53-5, and we won 39 games to start the season. We didn't win the last game of the year. But I can tell you that, I mean, at the end of the year, when it was all, I mean, we didn't play well the last 3 days of the season. But that didn't make us a loser. That's a fleeting thought process that you would put in a young person's mind, that it's all about what's on the scoreboard. Because then people compromise their integrity to figure out a way to just succeed on the scoreboard. Well, that's not right. That's not the things that you're trying to teach through sport, and the ideals of why sports should be there, through the competition, but also the sportsmanship of it. I get upset when we play other teams and they just run their mouth. I don't understand that. I don't understand coaches that allow that. They don't do that in Major League Baseball. They don't do that at you know, Power Five conference schools. They just go play the game and see what happens. And teams that coaches allow their team to run their mouth, I guess they think they're intimidating the other team per se. Mm-hmm. But good teams don't get intimidated. They laugh that stuff off and say, "Well,
right.
we're not in a trash talking contest right now. We're competing on the field with sport and the game that's in front of us." And I think, you know, coaches have got to really start, because I'm seeing more of that
right.
at all levels. And I'm seeing it. I'm going, what are you teaching these young people? You know, you're teaching that you're going to intimidate people by your words. You're going to treat, you know, that you can't go out and live off of what your work ethic is and how the talent that you have, that you got to figure out another way to come out on top. Well, equal level competition, they're going to laugh that off, and I don't think you deserve to win when you're doing that kind of nonsense. And,
right.
and you're going to, sooner or later, it's going to catch up with you as well. Right. And so I think championship rings, I've set our teams down after we've won national championships, and I've asked, do you feel any different today than you felt 6 weeks before? And they think it's a trick question, but at the end of the day, they don't. They don't feel any. What they do remember are the relationships that they had. And they remember that. They don't remember the statistics. They don't remember how many home runs they hit or things. And the ones that do remember that, they're pretty selfish. If they do remember those types of things.
Right. No, I actually had to have a conversation with a couple of our guys the other day, and you know, it is bad. Like, you know, it's the chirping from the dugout. And so I said, you know, they don't chirp at nobody's, and it's also usually guys that aren't playing. So that should tell you all that you need to know. You don't want to be that guy. But, you know, with that, I want to get into some, you know, you talked a lot about offensive development. I went through and watched your ABCA from 2020. I think it was a virtual one that you talked about just having a chaotic offense in a good way. Like you're trying to create runs in a lot of different ways. And so I'd love to hit on, you talked about the mental piece, you talked about really just your preparation. And so if it's a really good deep dive into that, but I'd love to be able to see how you're teaching it this fall of getting those guys and what you're teaching now, as far as, you know, preparing those guys to be able to continue to run the system that you've had success with.
Yeah. Every practice day, we'll spend at least 30 minutes on base running. I think it's a lost art. I don't think people understand that you can win and lose a lot of games based on base running. You know, we put our players on green light. We want them to own the game, own the situation. I think if you're the coach and you got to tell a guy to steal, he doesn't get as good a jump as he possibly could. I think he's able to see things out on the field with counts and breaking balls. He might pick up a, you know, if he's at first base, he may pick up something slight out of a guy's hand way coming set. Or he may be able to look inside and see the signs from the catcher to know that there's a breaking ball coming or an off-speed pitch coming. And the coach can't see those things. And so we let them play, let them run the bases. We want to teach when the right time to run is versus the wrong time to run. We're big on dirt balls. We practice dirt balls almost every single day. And if they throw us out and they pick the ball and they throw us out, well, hats off to them. But I've seen us win a lot of games by just moving a guy up into scoring position and then getting a soft base hit right over the shortstop's head. And we scored a cheap run because of that. I think that that's a part of it. I think the bunting game's a lost art as well. And I can I saw Altuve the other day, first playoff game, he led off with the drag bunt. He probably didn't do that all season long. But now all of a sudden it matters if you're going to win. And now you're in the playoffs, and a lot of other things kind of come to the forefront. We tell our guys all the time, if you can't bunt the baseball for a base hit, you're not going to play. The scouting report should be on us that every guy's going to bunt, and you're going to have to play in on the corners. And I don't care if it's a 3 and 4 hole hitter. They're going to have to respect that, because I think when they have to respect that, you open up all kinds of angles to be able to hit. And you may not bunt that whole game, but you got the defense out of position. I think running the bases correctly, if you're a runner at second base and the middle infielders have to pay attention to you, you may not steal third that entire game. But at some point, they are paying too much attention to you that they got out of position and the ball might have got through that we scored a run on that would have just been a ground out. And I think that it's that pressure that you put on the team. And then there's going to be an inning that – almost every baseball game is won when one team scores more runs in that one inning than the opponent scores the entire game. Well, that inning, you spun it out of control on them. There had to be an offensive catalyst that took place. And those catalysts are walks, hit by pitches, or an error that took place. And if those things happen, and then all of a sudden you add the base running in on that, the chaos, and then the bunting in on that, and then they threw a walk in there. Now, all of a sudden, 3-4 runs go up, and you might have had one hit. You might have had two hits. And you just won the game because you put the big crooked number up right then. And so it's to get people to understand and realize there's a lot more ways of getting the 3 runs on the board than hitting the 3-run home run. But you also have to have the ability to do that and get the big swing and get the extra base hits. And so I'm big on base percentage, and I'm big on slugging percentage and those things. And then if you can teach those guys how to bunt and how to run the bases, now you've got an offense that collectively puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the opposing team because they know that they can hit, they can run the bases, and they can bunt. And they're going to have to defend everything instead of just defending this team can really, really hit and let's play at the back of the infield through that. And so it's creating that thought process of the blood's in the water when that big inning starts to happen. And you'll hear it from time to time, the blood's in the water. Mm-hmm. This is the time right now that we've got to go on attack mode. We're going to have a guy that lays down a drag bunt, and they may get us out.
Yep.
But again, it was a pressurized at bat and we made them make a play. But just the sheer fact that your base runners have big leads and they've got to pick a bunch and it's bang, bang. Mm-hmm. And they start thinking, like, I'm going to pick that guy off. Well, they start to rush. Next thing you know, they throw the ball down the line. Mm-hmm. Or they're more focused on the base runner. Now they elevate the ball to the hitter that the double goes in the gap and we score from first base. Yep. We didn't steal the base in that bat, but just the thought process of this may happen created the chaos that we're trying to do. And so mm-hmm. it's you know, we'll hit and run from time to time, but I think you hit and run to stay out of a double play. And I'd far rather take the chance of not giving up an out than by stealing the base or getting a dirt ball than possibly hitting and running. But there are times where the pitchers are away. Now we've got to hit and run because they're feeding right into that thought process as well. That's so really that's the thought process behind the chaos. We practice bunting every other day, and it's not a BP round. It's only bunting for like 35 minutes out in the outfield. Mm-hmm. And we're in four corners and we're doing that. And guys don't get the bunts down. They got to do pushups and they do it on their own. We don't have to tell them because they know if we're sacrifice bunting, which we don't do a lot of, but if we're sacrifice bunting, game's on the line. Mm-hmm. Like this is like eighth, ninth inning, and you're trying to get one run. But we're big on drag bunting. And I think a lot of times sacrifice bunting situation can turn into a drag bunt situation. And it's a lot highly effective because they may throw it away because it's a tougher play.
Sure. You know, with that, so we obviously the weather in Oklahoma, there will be days that we'll be blowing out 30 or in 30. So having multiple ways to score is a big deal. But with bunting last year, I felt like, you know, we started off with, you know, teaching form, and then it's for reps. But then, you know, we'd get into the scrimmage, and then they would show too late, and then they'd foul it off by trying to run out of the box. So I don't know what you guys do, and I'd love for you to add to this, but we started doing called merry-go-round bunts. Where they would literally have to show, you know, we'd say, you know, we start with the pitcher's handbrake, like that's when we start our load, and that's when you probably need to start your show, which is a little bit later than a sack. But then the merry-go-round bunts would be like they had to bunt, take two steps out, take their bat, and then go around to the other side, and we'd have a group that was doing that. And then we do like short game in the dome or in our indoor of where it's like 20-foot bases, and they'd have to bunt and get it down and run just to – because I felt like we saw that a lot as opposing teams. Guys would try and drag bunt, and then they'd show too late. I don't know if you see that with your guys, but I see that quite a bit especially amateur hitters.
We don't have a set time of when they show. We just tell them they've got to get their body in position. Whatever they need to have happen, get their body in the correct position that they're not rushed, and they've got to bunt the ball before they run. I think another big thing is put the machine. Yep. Machine out there that's got high spin on it. Now it becomes a little more difficult. If our players throw the bunts in the four corners, they've got to put something on it. And if they don't put something on it, just go run because this is high stakes, high pressure situations that we've got to get this done. And if you're brother-in-law in this thing, you're throwing your buddy, nobody's benefiting from that. There's a couple of drills we do with hunting where we call a bazooka drill on a kin drill. Bazooka one is we put the bat on our shoulder, and then we just bunt the ball with the end cap.
Oh.
And so, and it doesn't matter where the ball goes. It doesn't matter if it goes foul, but that little end cap there, that's where they have to bunt it off of. And so they can't move the bat up and down. They've got to go up and down in their legs through that. And you'll see it the first couple of times. They're getting hit and it's ricocheting and they're going to get hit in the face. But after a couple of times, they start to they get really good at it. Mm-hmm. And now when they put the bat in their hands and they have to bunt, that becomes a lot easier because now you got a lot more surface area. So we do that one. That one's called the bazooka on our shoulder. And then we do one under our armpit. And we call that one the cannon. And the same thing happens. And so we start every bunting session out with that. And then the rest of the bunts become pretty easy, which is now you have the bat to be able to do that.
Right. And I mean, it's got to be like, I talked to our guys. I said, listen, Mike Trout probably doesn't bunt very often, but he could. Like he's got that in his toolbox.
Without a doubt. I think a little more offensive stuff. I mean, we're big on rhythms. You know, I think hitting this whole thought process, you look for a fastball and adjust to a breaking ball. That's nonsense. No way a big leaguer, the guy's throwing 100 miles an hour. The guy's looking for a fastball and they can adjust to a breaking ball that's 88 miles an hour and it's a hammer. You've got to get yourself into predictive counts and you've got to be able to have an educated guess of what's going to come at those points. And if you get fooled, then you get fooled. And then when you get to two strikes, it's get the ball in play. Now it becomes personal between you and the pitcher that's out there. Get the ball in play. don't head back to the dugout, with a strikeout. Because with lower levels of baseball, there's going to be more errors. Put the ball in play, make them earn those outs through that time. And so the rhythms of fastball rhythms and breaking ball rhythms and slider rhythms and things of that nature, we're big on that, but adjusting our BP rounds with that. We've gone off a lot of machine work now. I was hesitant about that. Last year we did it. We took a ton of batting practice off. We took a lot more BP off of machines on the field than live arms. And what it did was it replicated a spin rate and velos that are coming out of pitchers' hands. I thought it might hurt us a little bit, but not seeing the arm action of a BP thrower. But also, if I look at the big league guys right now, they're taking all kinds of BP off of machines and not really off of live arms very often at all, because those live arms throwing 55 to 65 miles an hour, they don't replicate a fastball that's going to be 98. And so get the high spin rates on those machines. It'll knock the bat out of the guy's hands at the start, but at some point they're going to start getting the barrel to the baseball. Mm-hmm. They got to be short to the ball, but also you replicate the breaking ball. No BP thrower can replicate a true high spin breaking ball. They can't. Those machines can.
I love that. I actually hired a couple of younger guys who are former pitchers, and they like throwing live to guys. I'm like, this is the best thing ever. We use machines. We got guys throwing live to hitters. Like, this is doesn't get a whole lot better than that. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
So you talked about routines as well, and how that was a big staple of your program. Whenever, you know, a lot of kids don't have routines. They just kind of leave it up to chance. But talk us through your process of teaching that side too, because that was a big part of your ABCA presentation, of just like from even like the second guy that's on deck, or yeah, the second guy in the hole, like you're starting a process of what it's going to be like whenever you get into the box. You even talked about like the on deck guy verbalizing, you know, stuff to the hitter too, like, you know, when it steals a base. But how do you guys teach routines?
Yeah, the on deck guys got it. I mean, we're running the bases so much that when our guys get good jumps, we don't want to foul a pitch off or put it in play when we're going to gain 90 feet on that. But your hitter's got to be comfortable with hitting two strikes with doing that as well. And so the on deck guy, he's responsible for watching the guy on base. And when he gets a good jump, he's got to yell, take three times as loud as he can. And sometimes the hitter don't hear it if you're in different venues, but most of the time they'll hear it and we're able to take. And it's, you gain 90 feet off that as well. And then, you know, we don't have our on deck guy chasing foul balls or chasing pit balls to the backstop. We have the guy that's in the hole, and we've even changed that now. We actually assign a guy in the dugout to be in charge of that now. So even our guy in the hole is timing up the pitcher and getting his timing and reps of that. You know, we want guys checking charts. That should happen before you get in the hole. Checking how did the guy get you out the previous at bat. You know, if you haven't had an at bat, pick a guy that's similar in the lineup to you and see what they did pitching staff wise to him and how they were trying to pitch him. Pitchers, even pitching coaches, they are creatures of habit. And a lot of times they're going to go back to the well of how they got a guy out the previous time. And at lower levels of baseball, like ours and yours, you know, we don't have synergy, and we don't have, you know, big league stuff where every pitch is documented where they can pull up the video of that. But those hitters in the big leagues, they got reports on what did the guy throw me two years ago, you know, and they've got all that information sitting there so they can document. And then they're able to take their educated guesses on what's going to happen in counts and how is that guy going to pitch me. That's why you see a rookie come up, and the rookie pitcher a lot of times has a lot of success against the hitters, because the hitters don't know how that pitcher is going to approach them. Sure. And then the data gets out on the pitcher. Then all of a sudden the hitter gains a huge advantage because that young pitcher hasn't had to make the adjustments that he's going to have to make. So it's all about the adjustments that the pitchers are going to make versus those hitters are going to make as you rise up higher levels of baseball because of the data that's available. It's just you don't have as much data available in high school or even in college sometimes as much as those professional guys have. And a lot of times we're making decisions as coaches on statistics and things, and there's not enough at bats and there's not enough things to actually make a statistical difference in what you're actually doing. So a lot of times your eyes got to tell you, what's going on. Not that batting average, because I think that batting average is a lie. Didn't tell you how hard you hit the ball. Didn't tell you who was playing shortstop. Was that shortstop he got a hit against? He wasn't very good, or the shortstop was a big leaguer and he made a play that nobody else is going to make. Sure. Didn't tell you who's playing center field and doesn't tell you who's on the mound. And so with all of that, you know, that batting average a lot of times is a lie. I think the whip for the pitchers is tremendous. You know, when you can, how many guys is a guy putting on base an inning? I think that's big in evaluating guys, not an ERA. Because again, that doesn't tell you who's playing shortstop that would make a play versus another guy as well.
No, that's good. So with that, did you want to hit on team building activities or anything that you guys do? I know you talked about the competition teams. Did you have anything else that you guys really feel like?
Well, I mean, every week in the fall, you know, we do some type of team competition. And
okay.
Have anything to do with baseball. You know, sometimes it's the simplest thing of everybody's got a paper, rock, scissors, and the winners of those two teams that are split apart, they'll get points for their team. Nice. I think the way we do our point system in the fall provides a lot of team building. Just because of that, because they really take ownership of their team. You know, yesterday, every Monday, I come out and read the score sheet of the previous week, and they're looking like, okay, where did we get points from? Mm-hmm. You know, a guy got lifter of the week in the weight room as a position player. Another guy got lifter of the week as a pitcher in the weight room, and then their team, one of those teams, got, you know, team lifter of the week for their team, and so they're anxious to see who won those awards and who got the points for their team. And they start to police themselves and they start to hold each other accountable. And I think that right there starts to build the chemistry and the camaraderie of what you're trying to accomplish.
No, I love that. I, like I said, I will never not do this again. Like it's been a really fun way to, especially because, you know, you've got guys who were there last year and then you've got brand new guys coming in, and it's a good way to integrate all of the different types of personalities. And we even started like changing lifting partners every couple of weeks, just to make sure that they're talking with more kids. Cause you see, it can be very clicky with our age group of kids.
Any age, any team.
Any age. Very true.
The job of the coach to break those things apart and put them in a position to succeed. I'll tell you what, coming out of COVID, something we did, we created academic teams. We had never done that. And so because everybody was back home and we were all quarantined, it was, all right, we need people checking up on people and teammates checking up on. Let's create these academic teams. So now they have to report that information to their academic team captain. That person is the liaison between me and them. So I don't have to worry about
awesome.
40 guys out there on what's going on. They control their own study hall groups. Mm-hmm. Like they get together, they do all of this, they help each other. And there's a point system with that goes into the points and the payout that'll take place. And so now, you know, they're making sure that they're going to class. They're making sure they're on top of their studies, because again, the whole group. So you win as a team, you lose as a team, you get praised as a team, and you get embarrassed as a team. And so when you can get everybody to understand those four facets of this, they start to look out for one another, and then they hold each other accountable when they're screwing up.
That's cool. One thing that did come to my mind too, because I want you to hit on this too. Your in and out routine seems to be like famous. So I can't remember maybe it was Steve Dinneman who was giving a presentation a couple of years ago. And he was like, we went down to LSU Eunice and we're already down 3-0 after In-N-Out. And so I would love to hear, you know, what your process is of doing that. Cause I think, you know, that's a competitive advantage and it's something that some teams do well, but a lot of teams just kind of go through the motions.
Yeah. I think we're big on infield and outfield. You don't do it to get loose. You don't get it to warm up. You don't do it for any of those reasons. I don't think you do it to intimidate the other team. I think you do it for scouts that are sitting in the stands, because that's the opportunity to show off your arm strength. That's your opportunity to show off hustle. It's your opportunity to show off that you can catch the ball correctly. Because, I mean, we focus on when you catch the ball, your glove should pop. If you catch the ball the correct way, it should pop. If it's like making two sounds when it's hitting, you haven't focused on catching the ball the correct way. And so focusing on all that, you know, I think all coaches are trying to figure out a way to get up on the scoreboard when the game's not going on. And you know, if Steve mentioned, I didn't hear that. But if he mentioned that, there's a byproduct of that. On the flip side, I know our team, we tell our team, we don't care about their infield and outfield. Like, don't even pay attention to it. go get some hacks, get some dry swings, get yourself ready to play base running stuff. Just get yourself ready to play. But again, it's high energy. It's moving around quickly. But again, it's for scouts that would be in the stands, not to get loose, not to intimidate another team. But if you are doing it the correct way, the other team will notice, like, these guys are ready to play because the ball's snapping around. There's a lot of talk going on. There's balls going all over the place all the time. But there's times where it doesn't work out, and I just run them off the field. Like, I mean, we've done that. I mean, we've been in playoff games, and the infield's not get off the field. Like, just get off. This we're wasting our time right now with it. And that's a way of, like, we need to check ourselves. We need to reset our mindset right now and do this a little better than what we were. And so it's for the scouts. It's for people that are in the stands.
No, it's good. I like that a lot. So let's get into some in-season, and then we'll get into, you know, you guys have been successful in the postseason as well. So anything for the coaches who are listening, who are like, I want to level up, you know, in-season practices, similar schedules probably. And then we'll get into some postseason here in a minute. But is there anything that you wanted to add of, like, being efficient in season, ways that you guys have stolen reps? And a lot of it comes back to, you know, you talked about continuous improvement.
I think when you get in season, you got to back your practice times off because then it's we're playing so many games. We're playing 56 games. And so we want to back off the practice times, not as long as practices. Because my big thing is making sure we're in the weight room, and we lift on game day. You know, if we play Friday night, we're in the weight room at 6:30 on Friday morning. In the weight room, making sure we're physically strong, make sure we're rested and ready to play the game. Shorten our practice times, and then focus on the big items. Like let's take some BP. Let's take a lot of BP. Let's take ground balls. Let's take some ground balls, but let's not overdo it. Arms with our arm care and things of that nature. You know, I think, Coach, we've got to practice the little things, but I think coaches sometimes over-focus on those things when those plays don't happen that often. You know, they want to go out and do a first and third situation for 30 minutes, and it's not going well. Why didn't you just move on after 4 minutes of it not going well? And understand, like, you can get mad all you want, but the momentum of this thing is not going well. Maybe bang it then and come back later on in practice and see if you can turn that thing around, instead of just beating the dead horse of those things. And so I think in season we're backed off a lot. And if we can do that, if we've taught how to handle situations during our fall season or our off season. High school, it's a little bit different because you got guys playing all these different sports, and you can, that's a little tougher scenario than what I'm dealing with that. And so if anything, during season, we're going to shorten our practice times, and we're going to go to more big ticket items than your smallest. We don't have bunt defenses all over the place. You know, we have one bunt defense. You know, I don't understand why teams need to put five bunt defenses in. You know, because people are giving up outs, take the outs. If you screw up one of those bunt where you're doing the wheel play and the wheel crash and everybody's crashing, and because I tell you, if you do that against us and you do it too early, we're gonna slash on you, and you screwed up by doing that. And I've seen teams against us, because we're going to bunt and we're going to do all those things. They got all these plays, and I'm going, we didn't have to bunt. We showed bunt, and our guy on his own slashed, and it just screwed you up at that point. And so I think when you can limit to yourself to one bunt defense, a basic bunt defense, and you become really, really good at that and making sure you get outs on bunts, you live to play another day, and you allow your pitcher to pitch out of some situations instead of teaching failure. I think a lot of times that coaches want to create all these different plays and things, and they're actually they're creating plays that are operating in failure instead of success. And so our guys don't have to worry about all these bunt defenses or first and third defenses. These are basic things we're going to do. And we'll, if they execute against us, make sure we get an out, and we'll see if we can pitch out of it, because they still got to execute on the other side of it. Whereas if you screw one of them plays up, free 90 happened, didn't get an out, and now big innings in question now.
I'm with you. Well, I've got a couple questions before we let you go. So we'll do some quick hitters here, and then I'll make sure I link your contact information down below. But, you know, what's a drill that we can steal from you that is going to be a win for us that your players love?
I think what I was taught, I don't know if this is a specific drill. I think you've got to limit the time that you're doing those drills and have and do a bunch of different ones. So now it's not mundane. If, and I understand there's got to be some mundaneness of practice and getting reps and things of that nature. But when you're moving things on in practice from this to this to this to this, they're in a, it used to be the TV channel mode where they're just flipping the channels. Or now it's the scrolling mode.
TikTok
if
mode.
If you do that way too long on those drills, you're going to lose them. You're going to lose the concentration. So move on to the next drill as quick as possible. And then it doesn't seem, they don't have any issue with any of them. They're able to get reps in, and you're able to have more quality reps in than quantity. And I think the quality is a lot more important than the quantity that's going on out there. We don't have a specific drill per se, but we're going to move quickly and not stay on something for a long time.
Oh, that's good. What is the latest thing that you've learned that's made you better at your job?
I think the that point system, when we did that, and that's not yesterday, but when we instituted that, I did not know that that would have that much of an effect of an accountability within the team itself. And when I saw that, the coaching part of it got a lot more enjoyable. I don't have to yell. I don't have to get on this guy. Guy misses class, his teammate goes and says, "Why'd you miss class? You just cost us 100 points."
Right.
Like, we're gonna have to do this payout that's hell at the end because you can't get your rear end to class and you can't do the simplest thing. And I think that's been one of the biggest things is letting the team really truly have ownership, talking about that, and then the accountability based on that point system. And you can develop a point system however you'd see fit based on your needs as well.
Sure. And that probably answers my last question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Maybe you've got something else, but what's one thing that you've implemented that you feel like has made the biggest impact of your program? And that could be from the start or lately.
Yeah, I would get out of the way of the assistant coaches.
Mm.
I think as a head coaches want to seem to think that they want to do it the right way, and they think they only know the right way. And why did you hire assistant coaches? Let your assistant coaches have ownership over that. Like today, I put the practice schedule out already, and it's got a base running segment on it right now. The coach that I have now played for us. Mm-hmm. He left here. He went and played at a Division I school. They were top five in the country in stolen bases. He learned something at that school. Mm-hmm. He learned stuff when he was here. Let him go. Let him go and let him teach the game. Let the assistant coach teach the offense and the pitching coach do this. You as the head coach, if you're able to step back and if you trust them guys, you shouldn't hire them if you don't trust them. And if you can't trust them, you need to move them out and get people in there that you can trust. But you need to empower them to be the coach that they want to be. And they can't learn if you're micromanaging it or you're putting your thumb on them and you're saying this is how it has to be done. So today I'll walk out to practice in base running, and he knows when base running's on it, he better have something prepared of what we're going to do. And he'll take it from there, and I'll listen, and then I add in some things that need to be done. But my job as a head coach, I need to oversee things, and I need to be able to look at individuals and see who's confident that day, who's not confident that day, and figure out how to push the buttons on individuals to get the best out of each and one of them. And if my head's down as the head coach, and I'm throwing all this BP, and I'm hitting all – you got to do it from time to time. But if you're doing all those types of things – then you're not seeing the big picture of how much better your team could actually be because you've micromanaged the people that are around you. Let your coaches go and empower them to learn and let them fail. Let them fail and teach through that. Because if I wouldn't have not had that before I got my job right now with the head coach I work for, he threw me right into the recruiting trail. Like, you're in charge of recruiting. Well, I'm 22 years old, just got done playing college baseball, and I'm thrown into this thing. If he wouldn't have done that for me, I wouldn't have gotten the job I got right now. And so I want to do that for our assistant coaches and empower them to be better than what they are and learn, really, really learn through mistakes and through hard work.
No, I love that. Well, Jeff, I appreciate your time, man. I've got a ton of notes over here to go through, and you've convicted me on several different things that I need to do better. And I always appreciate that. That's why I started the podcast anyways. But I did want to leave you some time to talk to our listeners. Is there anything else you'd like to tell them before you go?
I would just, as a coach, understanding it's not we're all competitive, highly competitive. We all like to win. But I asked the question of why did you get into coaching? Did you get into coaching to win baseball games? Did you get into coaching for a paycheck? Did you get in coaching because you were a college athlete and you were good? Or did you get into coaching to have a difference in young people's lives? And if you got into coaching for the first reasons I mentioned, you need to get out of coaching. But if you got into coaching for the right reasons to have impact on young people, you're going to have an immensely successful, enjoyable career in coaching. If you're not in it for the right reasons, the loss on the scoreboard is going to beat you up. The games that you thought you should have won or the mistakes that took place, you're going to lose sleep at night. But when you see a bigger picture and see about the success of your teams is going to be 10, 15, 20 years down the road, when all those kids have their own families, you're going to enjoy it a lot more than the thought process of winning and losing games. And it's a paycheck and I'm competitive and I was a college athlete and I know the game. That's not why you get into this business. You get in the business of changing lives.
Thank you so much for listening to Ahead of the Curve. If you would do us a huge favor, leave a rating or review wherever you are listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone and tag us on social media. That would help us so much with growing the show and helping others to stay ahead of the curve.